rummaging in the book bag again today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. We've been skimping on book reviews this season. Time to catch up on Scribble. I guess it is time to catch up. It's been a while.
Well, fortunately, it's been cold, so cold and icy that I've been a hermit and done a lot of reading of various odd kinds that I probably wouldn't have done before.
You know, I've been doing a lot of reading, too. Of course, I've been trying to dig out from under the paper. I really don't understand where it all comes from, because every time I throw out stacks of paper and my desk is clean, a week later I come back and I think, who did this?
The Japanese apparently have a name, and I can't remember the name, for books being piled all over the place.
Tsundoku.
on every little flat surface.
Tsundoku, I think.
Yeah, okay.
It's like a tsunami
right,
of books.
It is.
But mostly that refers to books that are there that you haven't read yet.
Well, I did make an impact on that stack.
Yeah.
Because of the cold weather.
Actually, I've done the same. So, okay, you
Well, let me begin. Friends of mine have been suggesting for years, and I don't know why I resisted, to read Jodi Picoult, P-I-C-O-U-L-T. Have you ever read one of her books?
No, I've heard the name, though.
I just assumed she was kind of a pop writer. But Bev Wilt, about a month ago, gave me a book called 19 Minutes. By Jodi Picoult, and I started reading it, and I could not put it down. It's a book that deals with a school shooting in which a young high school student, angered at the world, comes in with a gun, kills 10 people, and wounds many, many more. And the book deals with the effects of that. And we follow it meticulously. You know, they say it takes a village to raise a child, but I think what Jodi Picoult suggests is it also takes a village to prepare a shooter,
mm-hmm.
right? It isn't just one person getting angry. It's the whole, and what this book traces is how the shooter got to be a shooter, going way back to his life in grade school and how he was treated and how his teachers treated him, how his parents treated him, how the village treated him, down to the effects on everybody. And it's just, she does an amazing job of showing the how everything changes. One little act like that, big act, I guess. It reminded me of I.A. Richards, the English critic. One of the essays that I will never forget is his talking about how if you change one little piece in a work of literature, everything changes. And so he says, imagine there's a room with strings of different length filling the whole room, and at the end of each string, there's a balanced magnetized needle of different sizes. And so you've got thousands of needles. Eventually, he says, in that room, the needles will all adjust to each other magnetically, and the room will be still. Open the door and stick one needle, big, small, or any kind, into that room, and all the needles will slowly readjust. Hmm. That's exactly the plot of this particular book. All the needles in town because of this shooting. It isn't just the kids that were shot. It isn't just their parents. It isn't just the teachers. It isn't just the shooter himself. It takes the shooter from his grade school experience through the trial. And the effect, of course, on his parents are the strongest, but the effects on everybody. Really, she is a very good writer.
What's the name of the book again?
19 Minutes, which is the length of the time the shooting took place.
Oh, you know, it's odd how just something, one incident can change everything. but the meticulous research to find out what might have led to that instant. And, horrific effects. Well, I read a book called The Library by Susan Orlean. She grew up in a family that really went to the library. They just loved books. They ate books. But her mother was very practical, and they didn't have all that much money, so they went to the library. They didn't buy books. She later on became a reporter, and her work has appeared in The New Yorker and I think in The New York Times. And when she got out on her own, first thing she did was build shelves and fill them with books. She's just fascinated with books. When they moved out to California in Los Angeles, she went to a local library and then found out that they had a wonderful central library, and she had a man take her to, I can't remember his name now, Brecker, something like that. Anyway, he gave her a tour, and as he went through the library, he opened a book and sniffed at it. So, and she asked what he's doing. Says some still have the scent of smoke in them. And why was that? And they told her about the big fire. On April 28th, 1986, an alarm started in the Central Library. At first, people thought, well, it was just a drill. But suddenly it became obvious this was a serious fire. Every fire unit in the city responded. I think I have the notes here, a quote from it. In total, 400,000 books in Central Library were destroyed by the fire. An additional 700,000 were badly damaged by either smoke or water, or in many cases, both. The number of books destroyed or spoiled was equal to the entirety of 15 typical branch libraries. It was the greatest loss to any public library in the history of the United States. One fireman said, once that first stack got going, it was goodbye, Charlie. The fire reached 2,000 degrees and burned for more than 7 hours.
Wow.
And librarians, once they found out, you know, that this was a disaster, and citizens, they start handing books one by one, you know, a human chain trying to save the books. Later on, they centered on a guy named Peek, I believe. He was a blonde actor, would-be actor, and he was accused of starting the fire, but they could never prove it. And the unsatisfactory thing about the books when you go through all this is that they don't know for sure who did it. But along the way, she meets all kinds of interesting people and tells their stories. She talks about libraries, and some of the observations she makes about them are really great. Here's one. People think that libraries are quiet, but they really aren't. They rumble with voices and footsteps and a whole orchestral range of book-related noises. The snap of covers clapping shut, the breathy whisk of pages fanning open, the distinctive thunk of one book being stacked on another, the grumble of book carts and the corridors. This is a woman.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, you're the one who was advocating talking loud in libraries some years ago.
Libraries have gotten less quiet.
That's true. That's true. But another one of her quotes, in Senegal, the polite expression for saying one has died is to say his or her library has burned. When I first heard the phrase, I didn't understand it. But over time, I came to realize it was perfect. Our minds and souls contain volumes inscribed by our experiences and emotions. Each individual's consciousness is a collection of memories we've cataloged and stored inside us, a private library of a life lived. And another, librarian should read as a drunkard drinks, or a bird sings, or a cat sleeps, or a dog responds to an invitation to go walking, not from obedience or training, but because they'd rather do it rather than anything else in the world. This is a marvelous book, The Library Book by Susan Orlean.
I think you are ready to read, or maybe you have read, Borges' book, The Library of Babel.
What is that?
The Library of Babel, B-A-B-E-L. It's a short story, like all his.
Now, why have I heard of that? Have you told me about this before?
I'm sure I have. He's one of my favorite writers, and once I start reading him, I'm in a whole different world.
What's his name again?
Borges, B-O-R-G-H-E-S.
Okay.
He's an Argentinian writer.
Oh, yeah.
The greatest writer never to have won a Nobel Prize.
Ah. Well, there's...
Because of his political views.
Well, you haven't won a Nobel either, but you're a
no,
great
but
writer.
I'm no Borges either. I wish I could be.
Well,
you know, I...
Who else have you got to recommend?
Well, about 20 years ago, Nan Carter, our contact in Berkeley, introduced me to an Egyptian writer that I had never even heard of, called Naghi Mahfouz, M-A-H-F-O-U-Z, who it turns out is the only Egyptian writer to have won a Nobel Prize. I think he did that in 1980 sometime, for a trilogy called the Cairo Trilogy, which is just, it's like looking at the different threads in a tapestry as it traces several generations of a upper middle class family through Cairo. But she recently sent me a couple of other books that Mahfouz wrote in the 50s, which are really worth reading. If you have never read Mahfouz, pick up anything by him, and I think you'll enjoy it. He writes what I suppose we would call novels, except that the novel is not a form that is familiar to Arabic writers. So it's interesting to see what happens when they take the novel form and then try to incorporate it into their own literary tradition. The book I want to recommend is an odd one. It was banned originally. It was very controversial. It still is. Called The Children of Gebelawi, G-E-B-E-L-A-W-I, Gebelawi. Gebelawi, it turns out, is a mysterious figure who lives in a mansion hidden away at the end of an alley, which is a neighborhood in Cairo. He has given a set of directives as to how to live. And this book traces four different generations as different people talk about who, obviously, Gebelawi is God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And lives in this mansion, is hidden away, never revealed himself, as various different figures try to live by his dictates and try to get into the mansion and see Gebelawi and get a hold of those directives. The first one of these is called Adam, guess what, right, who has two sons, one of whom kills the other. And Adam gets kicked out of the alley.
Uh-huh.
The next one is, this all takes place in contemporary Cairo, but the second one is Moses. And he leads his people out of the alley, but he fails too. And then comes Jesus, who has a different take on how we ought to live, and he fails. And then comes somebody who is not named Muhammad, but who's clearly Muhammad, the prophet, and he has a different take on how to carry out the directives of Gebelawi. And then he fails. And then there is finally a fifth one, and I forget what the name of the character is, but obviously he's contemporary science,
mm-hmm.
rational science, and he has a solution as to mankind's problems. Meanwhile, the people in the alley, under whatever leader comes to try to lead them out of Egypt, find failure, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing works. Humans are humans, and whether it's Adam or Moses or Jesus or Muhammad or modern science, nothing works.
Don't
really
you?
Interesting.
Yeah. The name of the book again?
The Children of Gebelawi.
Okay. By Borges, B-O-R-G-E.
No, this is by
Mahfouz. Mahfouz,
Naghib,
right.
Mahfouz.
Yeah.
N-A-G-U-I-B is his first name.
Well, you know, I think we're destined to fail in all these levels because we are human. But our humanity is something that really is well based in other creatures. There's a guy named Franz de Waal, W-A-A-L, who back in 2016 wrote a book called Are We Smart Enough to Know That Animals Are Smart? He has a new book, which I must confess I have not read, but I have run into reviews of it, and they all give the same example. A Dutch biologist by the name of Jan van Hoof goes to visit a dying chimpanzee, 40 years old. And the chimpanzee is, you know, has refused to eat and so on, is clearly dying. He goes into her enclosure, touches her arm, and she kind of stirs and looks and suddenly sees him, and a big smile breaks out on her face. She lets out a squeak of recognition, reaches over and strokes the hair on him, and gets close to him and hugs him. That is a human emotion.
Right.
And the point of his new book, Mama's Last Hug, Mama was the name of the chimpanzee, leads you on an amazing traversal of the emotional life of animals. Fish, rats, dogs, of course, all animals. There's even one reviewer who said he had a similar experience. He was dealing with octopi, and one was dying, and he went to visit, and the octopus recognized him, rose up, and enwrapped him in tentacles. He says, animals have emotion. We continually dodge away from that, call it something else, a stimulus and so on. So it is time that we recognize that this emotions, they have the same basic physiology and brain chemistry that we do, that are involved in emotions. And this book, I am promised by everyone who has read it, the latest I think was in Science News, said there is a surprise, a delight, and a moving experience on every page. So I can't wait to get my hands on it, but I want to give you advance notice. Mama's Last Hug.
We owe a lot of our attitude toward animals as having no emotion and no feelings. You know, we're told that the minute the master leaves the house, the dog doesn't remember it at all, right? It's only nervous at 4 o'clock when the master is about to come home because it's just acting instinctively. It was Descartes who thought that animals were more like automatons. They didn't really feel pain, right? I mean, you could cut a dog's leg off. And in fact, one of my acquaintances at the University of Chicago in physiology, that was during the period when we were trying to figure out whether animals really feel, whether pain is learned. I mean, you've had the experience, I'm sure, that everybody has had of cutting yourself and you don't realize till you see the blood that it hurts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so is the hurt really there, or is your imagination as you see the blood create the hurt? Well, what he did was raise dogs from puppies on in pain-free or sensation-free environments, in padded cells, mm-hmm. without sound, without anything, until I forget how old they were. And then he would break one of their legs and see if they felt it.
Oh, boy.
And after a year, he decided they felt it.
Yeah, boy.
And so he couldn't get a dissertation out of it because the University of Chicago did not accept negative results. So he had to shift to something else.
You know, that we have used animals. We feed on now. But that's the problem. Life, which I've railed about a lot, not knowing what it is, but it demands that if you want to stay alive, you have to kill and eat other living things.
Almost every other thing, right?
Yeah, and vegetables are living things. Animals are living things. And that's the thing about life that some people find almost unbearable, that in order to stay alive, you have to kill and eat other living things. If you don't exactly kill them, you can be a fortuitarian, I think they call
right.
it, when you just happen to find something.
Right. A dead carrot.
Yeah. Or an apple that has fallen off a tree. And, but, Yeah, that's, I would recommend this because I'm certainly going to read it. And I, the reviews I've read, boy, they many of them go on at extraordinary length. But it's called Mama's Last Hug. That's easy to remember. By Franz, FranzDeWaal. It's a book to look for.
Dick Stahl has been, for 3 years at least, trying to write a poem about a gorilla at the Cincinnati Zoo that his sister, who's a medical doctor, attended in an illness. The gorilla had a child, and she claimed that somehow the gorilla was aware that how do you examine a gorilla to see if they have pain? That the, somehow the gorilla knew that this woman, this stranger here, was there to help her, and did not fight back. They didn't have to knock her out or anything. And Dick was so fascinated by that that I've seen probably 20 versions of a poem from the gorilla's point of view about this strange woman who wants to help me, and so far he hasn't.
Yeah,
he hasn't caught the right moment.
Animals are surprising, and they know what's going on. They really do. There's no question about that. We've not had that many animals in our house, but it's been a wide variety, and they know what's going on. It's frustrating in a way because you can't talk to them directly, and yet they seem to be able to communicate across species and so on, the way insects and flowers interact. And you say, how do they do that? Well, we can't. We are not only freed by self-awareness to imagine great things and invent and so on, but we're also prisoners of that.
Separated, yeah.
Yeah. It has built something of a wall between us and other living things, and that is dangerous. That wall should not be there. So anyway, that's a book. You have another.
Well, let me do one more Naguib Mahfouz book, because Nan Carter turned out to send me two. This is a really interesting one. It's called Midak Alley, M-I-D-A-Q Alley. And it is not a novel, really. It has no plot. It traces the fates or the lives in narrative form of about a dozen people who live in this traditional alley in Cairo. It takes place during World War II when the British are occupying Egypt. But they're not part of this alley. Outside the alley, there are jobs in industry, working hourly at plants. There's jobs working for the British government, cooking and acting as servants to some of the British soldiers who are there and so forth. But in the alley itself, life goes on as it has gone on for generations. There are no big restaurants. There are no big industry. There's a barber. There's a woman who cooks bread. There's a man who makes a living by taking people who would like to become better beggars, and he has a way of making them into fake cripples so that they look crippled, and he charges a little bit for this and gets a little money. There's a holy man who's very religious. There's a doctor who raids corpses to find false teeth so that he can sell false teeth cheaply to people who need teeth. It's just a great portrait. I mean, I got to thinking of my own alley in my little town in Mountain Lake, right? Across from us lived the guy that ran the Fairway grocery store, who was a state senator. Next to him lived Melvin, a friend of mine, who was a dropout in the eighth grade, who I don't think could read, but who won a contest. Every year, the band in Mountain Lake, Minnesota, had a contest for who could play Flight of the Bumblebee fastest. And he practiced and practiced the tuba, and one year he won.
On the tuba.
So his whole life, on the tuba, his whole life, he's the man who won Flight of the Bumblebee with a tuba. And then there was the boy who died in fifth grade. And, you know, you look at the stories – that you live among in your neighborhood. And that's what this book is. It's just, you know, it doesn't come to any conclusions. It just traces the lives of their hopes, their fears, their loves, their deaths. Mahfouz is really a writer you need to get in contact with.
There are not many neighborhoods where you have that kind of knowledge.
Not left.
Yeah.
Not left. But we grew up in one.
Yeah, I grew up in one too, but that was a long time ago.
And when we came and lived on 8th Avenue and 39th Street, there was still a neighborhood there. In fact, twice a year, I think, down at Longfellow School, we would have a neighborhood potluck, and there would be Mexican food and Greek food, and you know, we brought Norwegian food, but the neighborhood is pretty much gone these days.
Yeah, it's funny how, and I've wondered about that, speculated and written about it too, about how we have a hard time establishing community in this day of sharpened individualism. And to achieve that, we've sacrificed something that maybe we shouldn't have.
Well, you remember, you read that book, Bowling Alone, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's really...
Yeah, that talks about how the things we used to do in groups we don't do anymore. So the name of that Mahfouz book is...
Midak Alley, M-I-D-A-Q.
Okay, before we scoot out of here, A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking has been a very popular book, but it is not exactly an easy book. So a book that's out now will help you a lot. It's called Brief Answers to the Big Questions by Stephen Hawking. People kind of garbage things up, put together some of his essays and so on. And there's a nice foreword to the book by Eddie Redmayne, who played Hawking in the film Theory of Everything, film of his life. There's an introduction by his colleague and friend, Kip Thorne, who discovered gravitational waves, and then a nice afterword by his daughter, Lucy. But he dips into a variety of things, you know, about the Big Bang, and he goes into artificial intelligence, the race between technology and wisdom, how aggression mixed with human technology could very well destroy mankind. He is unhappy with the anti-immigration movement in the world. He's all for good education, the National Health Service, and space exploration. Just a brief statement on a lot of different topics in language you can understand. So if you backed away from A Brief History of Time, Brief Answers to the Big Questions may give you a taste of Stephen Hawking. If you've not read any of his works before, this would be a really good introduction. And I would recommend it, along with all the other books we've talked about today. But at this point, I would recommend that we push the music button and start out of here. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back to talk to some librarians for the next 2 weeks on the next two editions of Scribble.